This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. All Roads Ministry is a Roman Catholic lay evangelistic and apologetic and motivational organization. This particular series of tapes consists of the observations of Joseph Calley. When you are to think of the name of Joseph Calley, I would like you to associate with that name a man, full grown, who was a Congregationalist minister and became a Catholic. And because of his, shall we say, observations from the outside, it is hoped that these particular observations will be of use and benefit and profit to Catholics who have never seen their faith, their church, their religion as an outsider would. This particular tape is tape number 2 in a title, Why Be Catholic? The speaker is not Joseph Calley. It is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. But as I hope you will agree with me, it really does not matter the source or the speaker. It matters the words and the truth behind them. And that's what determines the value of any particular sentence, paragraph, or novel. And the same is true with any religious observation. Whether Joseph Calley were a Catholic all his life or a Catholic only recently, what he observes is independent of who he is. In the first tape of this two-tape series, Why Be Catholic, many or several observations were brought up concerning the difficulties one would have being a non-Catholic and trying to deal with God. In this particular tape, we would like to start out with another subdivision. This would be subdivision 5 on why one should be Catholic, and it is entitled Saving One's Soul. I would like to start out in dealing with this subject, that is, salvation, by using an analogy. Most men will watch the Super Bowl, which is the climax and championship game of the professional football season. These observers, these men, will especially watch the game if they are interested in the triumph of one of the teams. The degree of interest gets greater if one of these teams is the most favorite team of the watchers. The degree of interest increases more if they have been following the fortunes of this team for a long period of time. The degree of involvement increases further still if these fans have tickets to actually be at the game and not merely observe it at some distance on TV. The degree grows greater if they used to play for the team or are some type of part owner. The degree is greater if they were to be part, a member that is, of the coaching staff. However, the degree is highest if they are actual players. And if this individual fan is the star quarterback, the man upon whom the entire game plan rests, that is, the execution of the game plan, then the intensity cannot be higher. By the same token, the wives of these fans are frequently bored on Super Bowl Sunday. They usually have no interest in the game. Of course, the wives of the players are quite a different case. They are quite interested. The reason is that if they are good wives, their love for their husband makes the big difference. Love usually does. There is a conclusion from this rather prosaic and simple and obvious example of human behavior. To To put it in very simple terms, what man is involved in, he tends to be more interested in. The more he is involved in the activity, the more interested he is in the activity. The real fan will read as much as he can before the game. Even though he watches the game, he will read about it in the newspapers the day after the game, and he will even watch the replays on the TV that night. He will argue about the game with his friends at work or at the bar, and each time he will enjoy it again and again, assuming, of course, that his team wins. We humans enjoy winning. We humans enjoy rooting for the winning team. We would enjoy more being part of the winning team. We would enjoy most being the key player on the key play which wins the Super Bowl game. These truisms are certainly nothing new. This is the way we humans are. One could argue that this is the result of natural law. This view is essentially the Catholic view. It holds that man's nature, not being destroyed by the fall of Adam, is still, by and large, the way God created it. This action, this motivation, the things which interest us, therefore, are the way God wills it to be. At first glance, it would appear that even if one looked at this matter, that is, of interest, activity, from the Protestant point of view, it would not make much difference. The Protestant holds that man's nature is now quite different, essentially different, than from the way it was before Adam fell. To the Protestant, man is not merely crippled, he is, in a very real sense, dead. He is utterly unable to function as he was intended to function when created by God. To the Protestant, everything man does, everything he wants, or everything he inclines towards, is not only the result of the fall of Adam, it is also quite essentially evil. However, both the Catholic and the Protestant would agree to the more basic observation stated above. Men are more involved as they become more interested, and vice versa. They are more interested as they become more involved. As I said, upon first glance, this seems as if this is not a significant difference. If both Catholic and Protestant see an aspect of man's behavior in the same way, then why does it matter if they see the cause differently? To the medical doctor, it does not matter if the wound is a result of a crime or an accident or self-inflicted. The doctor's task is to repair and heal. I hold that understanding the difference, this difference, in the point of view is essential to understanding the nature of man, the nature of salvation, and the nature of God, in so much as it affects the God-man relationship. It is one of the most basic differences about which men can disagree. It is essential to truth and to the proper relationship with God. And it is one of the great strengths of Catholicism. I believe that the reason why so few Catholics realize this is that they need to understand or try to understand things from the Protestant viewpoint. And as so few do this, they fail to understand the value and inherent attractiveness of their own Catholic truth. To demonstrate what this strength is, allow me to continue to use this sports analogy. Imagine before the big game, the coach takes the key player aside and asks that he will not, and tells him that he will not be allowed to play in the game. The player asks why, and he is told it is because he may be hurt during the game. The coach explains that this is an act of love. When the player stands on the sideline to watch the game, the owner of the team tells him to watch the game from the stands, not the sidelines. He is told that if he stays too close to those actually playing in the game, he may become jealous of them and be upset. This is an act of love, the owner tells him. Well, the coach tells him. When the player goes to the stands, the head usher tells him to leave the stadium, lest the fans become angry at him because he is not playing. Out of love for him, so the usher says, he makes him leave the stadium. This player goes to a bar to watch the game on TV. The bartender asks him to leave. If he watches here at the bar, he may become too excited and may cause a problem. We all know that violence goes with alcohol. The bartender escorts him out and expresses his love and concern for his safety as he asks him to leave, and of course his reputation. Players shouldn't be in bar brawls. Of course, it's an act of love. The player goes home, and after he's put the game on his own TV, his wife turns off the set. She explains that if he watches, and if his team might lose, then he would become depressed. Her motivation for turning the set off is, of course, love. This bizarre scenario is designed to demonstrate the following principles. We humans want to be involved with that which we care about. To remove us from the activity is to lessen our enjoyment. For certainly you understand that as each stage progressed in the analogy, the player had less and less enjoyment until finally he had none at all. With this in mind, now add one more factor. Before the player is told that he cannot play, he is told that the game is fixed. The opposing coach has been bribed, and so have the officials, and the scorekeeper, and the timekeeper. The fix is in. There is no way that one team can lose, nor any way the other team can win. What I have described is not at all exciting, nor enjoyable, nor even interesting. After all, now the player will be watching, in a sense, an instant replay of a game because he knows one side is going to win, the other side is going to lose. Even the most rabid team player would find it very difficult to keep his interest in such a game. And if all those involved told him that love in action means having nothing to do with winning or losing of this game, the player is likely to lose interest. I describe the above scenario as being centered around the Super Bowl because it is an event of interest and concern to many men. It also is quite specific in a time and a place. It has an ultimate outcome of success or failure, of course, depending which team you're rooting for. Nonetheless, it remains only a sporting event. Other things are, certainly, in an absolute sense, far more important. Allow me to shift the focus a bit, and please keep in mind the image of the Super Bowl and interest and activity, and also the factor of a fixed game. It cannot be denied that the most important thing in life is man's salvation. By this I mean, in its simplest terms, the saving of a man's soul from the fires of hell. It should be the most important thing in any man's life. Everything should be judged by whether it brings salvation closer or pushes it farther away. Salvation is an event which has a specific time and place and has an ultimate sense of success or failure. Let me now return to an earlier point. For us humans, interest and involvement are interdependent. Thus, if a man should be interested in his salvation, then it would help if he were involved in it. If he were involved in it, it would help his involvement if he were interested in it. I hope that this does not appear so much as profound as very simple and elemental. It is, I hold, all three: profound, simple, and elemental. Now let us attempt to see this matter from the point of view of God. God can do whatever is not against his nature. God is, in a very real sense, love. The love of God is expressed in action, as the nature of God is such that what he wills, and love is an act of will, occurs. Although certainly there is much more to the nature of God and the nature of the man-God relationship, this is, I believe, enough to establish my argument. Number one, God is love. And number two, what God wills happens. And number three, the love of God for man is an act of will. If God wills for man to be saved, then he could bring this about in only one of two ways. Either God predestines all men, some men, or no men, to be saved, and nothing at all that anyone ever does or ever will do will ever change this eternal decree and judgment. Or, on the other hand, man needs to do something in order to achieve salvation. Because man needs to do something does not mean that man causes his own salvation. If a man wins a lottery, he did not cause his number to be chosen, yet he still must go somewhere to buy the lottery ticket, and then he must pick up the money somewhere if he is actually to have it. Let us examine very briefly these two positions. First, what I call the do not bother position. This places natural barriers between man and interest in his own salvation. And these barriers are placed because of the specific actions of God. God created man so that he would function in the interest-involvement nexus. Remember, what man is involved in, he's interested in, and vice versa. Or, if this is as a result not of God's specific creation, but as a result of the fall, God did not choose to preserve man from this natural tendency. No matter, man is interested in that in which he may be involved, and in this view, he simply cannot get involved at all in his own salvation. Again, I'm dealing with the do not bother predestination position. So to speak, the game is fixed, and everyone will tell him not to bother with the matter. He is told that the most important thing in his life is utterly beyond his control. This will, of course, lead to indifference and unhappiness. Man is now the player, removed by degrees from each stage in the involvement, as I described before. Yet he is told that the God who loves him, who wants his happiness, who made man literally the center of creation, has now set up a system which is designed to frustrate any enjoyment in the very process of salvation. I digress slightly. What I have described is the so-called pure Protestant position. Whether anyone believes it or not, it is the reference point from which the Protestant starts when he talks about salvation. Most of the Protestants hold vague, confusing, and contradictory views of what salvation is and how it is achieved. However, When compared with the Catholic position, the Protestant will usually return to the pure position. One of the reasons why Protestants are so ambiguous on this issue is that they start from the do not bother position. Protestant theology, from its very inception and invention, disinclines the Protestant from any inquiry into or involvement with the subject itself. There is the story of a famous football coach who addressed his players during the halftime of a big game. He tried to put the matter into a realistic perspective. He told them that whether they won or lost, over a billion people in China did not care either way. The Protestant position makes Chinese football fans of people who should be active, eager, Catholic fanatics. Remember, fan is a short version of fanatic. The Catholic position, of course, points out that virtually everything in life, virtually every act, thought, and desire puts man closer to heaven or to hell. The game is not fixed, its score is going to be close. It is going to require everything we have, and we are going to have to be perfect. It is not a matter of life or death. It is more important than life itself. The coach not only tells us not to go away, tells us not to go to the stands, tells us not to stay on the sidelines, but he demands that we play every play to the fullest, and he will evaluate us on everything we do on that field. In a case such as this, the plan of salvation involves man totally. It becomes a case of man being created for salvation. In the other case, in the pure Protestant view, it isn't clear why man is created at all. If he is going to go to heaven after he dies, no matter what he does, then a truly loving God will take him home, that is, kill him, immediately after conception. Why would a loving God place man in a situation where he may do wrong, may commit adultery, may turn his back on his fellow man in need, and learn to hate God, to suffer pain and loss and agony? Why should man be in these circumstances if none of them matter at all? And if none of them do affect or effect salvation, then none of them matter at all. The question then becomes this: would a loving God make it so that life is nothing but a rather unpleasant waiting room for heaven? Would a loving God place impediments in the way of man trying to play in the only game which matters? Did God not realize what man was like? The answer is obvious and self-evident in the true sense of that term. It is evident that if God is love and if he is all-powerful, then he would arrange the world to be not in the Protestant nothing matters way, but in the Catholic everything matters way. The Protestant might object that this is merely a human way of looking at things. He might say that we are projecting our own wishes upon a supreme God. However, the Catholic position is that man is willing, capable, and desirous of doing good things. For the most essential attribute of the quality of good is that it helps bring salvation closer. The real question, the only objection, becomes this: if God would arrange this, if he could he? The Protestant would argue that to allow man a part in this salvation plan is to lessen the majesty and the power of God himself. If man has a part in these things leading to salvation, then it is man and not God Who determines who is in heaven or hell? This is, of course, a very important and a very profound question. I do not intend to deal with it here in a theological way. I intend simply to point out that in the Bible, frequently life is used as a metaphor for salvation and death as a metaphor for damnation. I believe that I am safe grounds in using this approach in dealing with an answer to this question. Certainly, we all know that it is God who gives life. It is God who creates new people. Yet, it is we humans who co-create with God. No one is foolish enough to deny the existence of the soul, which no man can infuse into the human body. But no man is foolish enough to deny that in a normal course of events, it is we humans who supply the raw material for the body. It is, in the truest sense of the word, a cooperative effort between God and man. It seems that God is showing us that cooperative efforts are natural, part of his plan for us, and yet supernatural, all at the same time. No Protestant, no matter how, quote, pure, unquote, his theology, will state that God's majesty is insulted or his power is compromised when a new human life is conceived. Unless we are to hold that somehow this most elemental fact of life is of no importance in our understanding of how things work, we must accept that God is teaching us something. And what he is teaching us is that when we cooperate with him, we do not lessen his authority, but simply fulfill his will. The Catholic may very well fail to understand that the Catholic view, that is God's plan of salvation, is one which man cannot only accept as rational and true, but also accept as more enjoyable. God did not make man to be unhappy, neither on earth nor in heaven. And, as the nature of co-creation shows, cooperation between God and man is not against the divine will, and cooperation is not co-correction. Co-creation is not an unhappy event in most cases. The Catholic view of happiness, the value of life, and life being both interesting and involving, must all be accepted as true, and all, of course, explain why one should be a Catholic in order to understand and appreciate these facts. Please turn over to side two, where this subdivision will be concluded. Thank you. Why Be Catholic, tape two, continued, side two.
I ask the question, would God make it pleasing to us if he could? Is this not the very way that love works? Could it be that the most important thing in the world somehow lacks interest and love? I hope that you see that the answers to these questions are self-evident. And I hope you see that these self-evident answers lead one to accept Catholicism. It's one of the answers to the question, why be Catholic? The next subdivision is Salvation, Part 2. Again, we're dealing with a series of topics on why be Catholic, and I've divided them into what I hope are convenient and logical subdivisions. If I may be allowed to another subtitle to this subdivision, I would like to entitle this Abortion versus the Holy Mass. For I hold that the immoral mentality which leads to abortion is based upon a root rejection
of the meaning of the Holy Mass as a sacrifice and its role in salvation. In the other subdivisions, I hope that my observations have been of a somewhat intuitive nature. In this, I hope to be a bit more logical and more rigorous in my reasoning. Let me return to the issue of salvation. I take as one of my major premises that salvation can be brought about by the action of God. Man cannot earn this status. Man may obtain it, but it must be, so to speak, God created. I take as another major premise that salvation is brought about because of the death of Jesus on the cross. To put it slightly differently, if Jesus had not died for us, we could not enter heaven. The entire issue of salvation, no matter how mysterious, no matter how profound, no matter how important, is ultimately reduced to this one simple question. How is the effect of the death of Jesus applied to us men? It is clearly agreed by all, both Protestants and Catholics, that the death of Jesus was a sacrifice to God for the sins of men. This is not to say that this is all that death was. I am trying to simplify matters by dealing with only this one aspect. If I do not refer to something, this does not mean it does not exist. It simply means that I judge it is not directly material in this part of the exposition. The sacrifice makes it possible for a man to have his sins forgiven. Again, so far, there is no disagreement between Protestant and Catholic. The matter is now this. Is the sacrifice merely an historical event, or is it something more? If the sacrifice is merely an historical event, then the most we humans can do is remember it. If it is more, then we can celebrate it. Let me use an analogy to illustrate my meaning. A birthday is, in one sense, an historical event. A person is born only once, regardless of what born-again Protestants would say. Yet we have birthday celebrations. Each of these is both a memorial event and a celebration in its own right as a different event. If a child were to die before his first birthday celebration, then the parents could hold a memorial service, but they could not celebrate a birthday party as the child is no longer present. Celebrations require the central presence of the party involved. If we are to hold that Jesus is gone forever until the second coming, then truly the most one could do is have memorial services. This is precisely what the Lord's Supper, the Protestant worship service, is. A memorial, a remembering, a symbolic, but nothing more than symbolic, acting out of something which occurred and was finished a long time ago. Allow me to deal with the concept of being finished. If the salvation of men, that is to say, all men who are going to be saved, was achieved once Jesus died, then not only can man do nothing at all to bring about his salvation, but once again, life loses all meaning. This statement is a logical necessity from the Protestant view, which says, in essence, it's all over but the dying. To go back to the sports analogy, if one team is far ahead and there's very little time left, then it is all over but the official score and the counting off of the seconds on the clock. This becomes self-evident, this Protestant view, and why it holds that there's nothing in life left but the dying, If one asks the simple question, what is life for? Obviously, God calls each of us into existence for a reason. Life has a purpose. Our lives have purposes. However, if the salvation of man is over, if we are already saved because of the historical event which occurred just outside Jerusalem so long ago on Calvary, then life has no relationship to salvation. Life becomes nothing more than the time between being conceived and the time of being taken into heaven or thrown into hell. Let me for a moment return to the celebration memorial metaphor. Let me deal with Christmas. Christmas is both a memorial and a repeated series of individual celebrations. At Christmas, we give each other gifts. The time before Christmas is not a gift, as any child will earnestly testify. It is a far too long and seemingly unnecessary delay between the desire for some toys and the time of actually opening the presents. Because of the inherent nature of the holiday, the loving parent cannot give the Christmas present before its time. However, bear in mind that God is not bound by any such temporal restrictions. Christmas is both a memorial per se, by which it is used to convey information, namely that the incarnation took place in Bethlehem many years ago, and a celebration in se. Each yearly celebration of Christmas is different from every other one. I point out this simply to establish the point that something which is historical can yet be perpetuated throughout time, both as a memorial and as a representation. Christmas, the real one, happened only once. Christmas, December 25th, happens every year. There is no contradiction between these two statements. The Protestant objection that the sacrifice of Jesus cannot be extended throughout time is weakened, if not defeated, by this analogous fact about Christmas. I must emphasize that this does not constitute a theologically perfect argument for the Holy Mass. I am simply offering some observations which show that the Catholic view is not impossible and really quite reasonable. Now let me expand to the overall view of human life. Let me posit that as a reality, the cliche that life is a gift from God. We all say this, but what does it really mean? God does things for a purpose. In other words, God creates man for a purpose. Life has a purpose. If we hold that the purpose of man is to achieve salvation, or even the purpose of man is to be thrown into hell, then the purpose cannot take place until we die. It in a very real as well as grammatical sense, death is the end of life. Death is the transition into the way men shall spend eternity, which is naturally more important than the where we spend our earthly existences, simply because eternity is infinite, while human life is, relatively speaking, quite short, instantaneous. If salvation has already been achieved before we come into existence, before we are conceived, if the result is not applied until after we die, then death is nothing but an interruption between cause and effect. the only reasonable thing to do is to cut short this existence. Remember, it is simply a waiting period until the end, the goal, the destination. God is not always reasonable in human terms, however. God does not waste his time and effort. By reasonable here, I mean reasonable with quotes around it. It would be reasonable, as I say, to cut short life. But God is not reasonable in the sense, reasonable from a Protestant point of view. God does not waste his time and effort. Human life becomes a waste of time and effort. It does, that is, if the Protestant view is accepted. If this view is true, then God gives us a gift of life, but we cannot use it. It is similar to giving a child a gift which requires batteries to operate and then denying the child the batteries. All men wrestle with the eternal questions. Why am I here? What is life for? Is this all there is? The Protestant holds that these questions are useless even to ask because the answer is predetermined. And even if you could learn the answers, there is no way to change the effect. That is to say, there is no way to change what's going to happen. So as the cause is already over and done. The Protestant is quite literally a passenger on a sinking ship. If he is rescued, depends on the speed of the rescue ship and the rate of the sinking of the ship he is on. He totally rejects the concept of swimming for shore, so therefore he simply waits to see what happens. He has no control over the events. He has no way to aid in the saving of his own life. Again, this is the Protestant point of view. Yet, notice, if the Protestant view is true, we humans refuse to accept it. If life is meaningless, if everything is over, we humans should place no value on life, including our own existence. Yet we do very much so. We struggle, Protestants included, to stay alive. We would all swim for shore, even if we thought it were 1,000 miles away. God has given us a so-called gift, which we value greatly, but which, according to the Protestants, is a cruel deception. Life is useless, according to the Protestants. No man can accept in his heart that God is such a nature in reality. But if we do accept it even intellectually, then certain consequences follow. No one willingly goes to an unpleasant place for a vacation. A vacation is for pleasure. It is not for health or business or education. In other words, a vacation is not involved with the important things of life. If it is not enjoyable, then it is a failure. No one should go on vacation if he foresees that he will not have a good time. These may sound like bromides and rather platitudinous truisms to you, but sometimes truisms lead to new truths. Notice the analogy with human life. Human life really does not have anything to do with the important things, namely salvation or damnation, again, according to the Protestant. Thus, human life should not be accepted unless it is going to be enjoyable. Because human life, again, according to the Protestants, is like a vacation. It does not have anything to do with the important things of life, but only the unimportant things of life. Recreation, enjoyment, happiness. But this would mean that human life should not be accepted unless it is going to be enjoyable. It is not a gift in se, in itself. So, if you do not foresee that you will, quote, enjoy a daughter right now, and if you conceive a daughter right now, according to the Protestant, abort her. Why not? It really doesn't make any difference in the important matters, because human life doesn't make any difference in the important matters. The death of the child, the death of you, the abortion that you bring about, none of these things will change salvation. Since they don't change salvation, life is a vacation. And why have a squalling daughter on your hands to ruin your vacation? It really doesn't make any difference in the important matters. If you foresee that the child would not be a pleasant thing to have right now, then contracept. If a gift is not going to serve any purpose of enjoyment, then it involves no loss to reject it. Remember, we're talking about a gift here, not a necessity. Actually, when we look back on it, most of life is a veil of tears, as it says in the Hail, Holy Queen. At best, we have a few good moments a week. The rest is boring, routine, or unhappy. What kind of gift is this? Not only are there no batteries, but the toy does not work anyway, and the metal edges cut our fingers. The only important thing is salvation, and this is a closed issue. Do not bother about it. This is the ultimate basis of the abortion contraception mentality, and its intellectual genesis is in Protestantism, and in Protestantism's misunderstanding of the salvation of man. Let me return to Christmas. Would it be a Christmas present if the parents, instead of giving gifts to the children, would simply remind them of what they got the year before? Or would the children react how would the children react if the parents simply recalled how they themselves, that is the parents, received presents from the grandparents back in the good old days before you were born? This seems absurd, doesn't it? It is. Parents, if they are loving parents, do not simply remind children of what was and how it was like in the old days. They arrange it so that children can enjoy what is, that is to say, the present. The parents celebrate the child's birthday, the loving parent does, because the parent, if he is Catholic in his view of these things, sees the child as a gift, something, someone, to be celebrated simply because he exists and because life is more than a vacation. It is a wondrous, marvelous gift and a wonderful, marvelous thing and important. The parent not only celebrates the fact of birth, he renews this fact of birth once each year on the memorial of the birthday. We humans do this once a year because of custom, but also because of our limitations. Quite frankly, we are too consumed with our own daily lives and too weakened by our own sins to really celebrate those we love every day. Unlike the Alice in Wonderland characters, we do not celebrate on birthdays. As one of the characters said, you only have one birthday a year, but you have 364 unbirthdays. parents go to work and sleep and get tired because of the fall of Adam. But I hold that if this were not the lot of us men today, we would really like it if we could celebrate our children and ourselves every day. And we would really like it even more if every day our parents celebrated both our birthdays and our unbirthdays. I may have made some points related to the reason why you can only justify and defend the sanctity of life from the Catholic point of view, but I don't believe I've related this fully directly to the concept of the holiness of the sacrifice of the Mass. Let me try to do this again, and I point out again that this is not a very precise theological defense or explanation. I'm trying to put things in normal human terms, not that they will be in any way blasphemous or sacrilegious, but I'm trying to simplify profound mysteries. The point is this: in a very real sense, Jesus on Calvary gave us himself. He became the Lamb of God to serve as a sacrificial lamb for us so that our salvation could be achieved. It was, of course, the greatest gift possible. Now imagine, if you will, a loving parent who could give to his child on his birthday exactly what the child desired. Let's say there were no limitations on money or maintenance, etc. For most children aged 5, 6, 7, this would probably be a pony. But if you gave the child a pony on the 4th birthday, if you gave him a pony on the 5th birthday, it simply would not be the same. You could not duplicate your effort, even if the child were still enamored with the pony. You could not give him a second one and expect him to evaluate it and to appreciate it in the same sense that he evaluates and appreciated the first. So we have the situation where you have to give the child a new gift each time, and the new gift may not be as good, through no fault of your own, if you're a loving parent, as the old gift. But still, you want to give the child a gift each time. That's what loving means. Now, let us do away with these human imitations, and let us suppose the hypothetical perfect situation would be this. The parent would give to the child a perfect gift, and would give the child the perfect gift on each birthday, which somehow would be the same because it would be the perfect gift, and somehow would be new because it would be given again. And of course, if the parent were perfect and not tired and not subject to the sin of Adam and those debilitating effects on the nature of we humans, the parent would give not only on the birthday, but on the unbirthdays, 365 days a year. The parent would give the best possible gift to the child, each day the same, each day new. Of course, we humans can't do this, but God can, because there is nothing inherently contradictory in any of these things that would prevent God from doing it. Can God give what is perfect and good and the best? Of course. Can he give it again and again and again while it is still the same? Of course, because God is not limited in time. And if Jesus gave us the best possible gift on Calvary, which is related to our salvation, namely himself, then unless he is not perfectly loving, or unless he is not God, he will give us himself again and again and again, each time the perfect gift on every one of our birthdays and every one of our un-birthdays. And once again, he will give himself for us to the Father in the sacrifice of the Mass, and to us physically as we receive Holy Communion. Allow me to tie this together if I can. If life actually has meaning, if the extension of time on earth is related to our salvation, and it is related to our salvation because of the death of Jesus on the cross and the sacrifice he achieved, and if this is the best gift possible, and if this gift is given to us again, then it is the holy sacrifice of the Mass which makes life meaningful, because it is the act of salvation carried out for us again, and we may participate and observe and commemorate and celebrate and honor and receive all at once, always new, always the same. And life is not meaningless. Life is not merely the waiting time period between conception and judgment. Life is the big game. The score is not fixed. And not only are we required to play every play, we know exactly where to go to get those things which are needed to sustain us, namely Jesus himself. So there, those who deny the sacrifice of the Mass, the meaning of the Mass, the perpetuation of Calvary and the sacrifice of the Mass, deny the meaning of life. And if you deny the meaning of life, you cannot morally, intellectually, philosophically, or theologically oppose abortion. Thank you for listening. Again, this was tape 2 in Why Be Catholic. Hope you've appreciated it. Hope you will obtain other Joseph Cally tapes available from ARM. You can contact us at ARM55 Palen, PALEN Road, number 38, Hope Well Junction, New York, 12533. Thank you for listening. Vin Lewis here. God bless you.